This episode is sponsored by a company I've used for well over a decade, and that is 5.11. I wore their uniforms back in Anaheim, California, and have used their products ever since. From their incredibly strong yet light footwear to their cut uniforms for both male and female responders, I found them hands down the best workwear in all the departments that I've worked for. Outside of the fire service, I use their luggage for everything and I travel a lot, and they are also now sponsoring the 7X team as we embark around the world on the Human Performance Project. We have MRF coming up in May, and again, I bought their plate carrier. I ended up buying real ballistic plates rather than the fake weight plates, and that has been my ride or die through MRF the last few years as well. But one area I want to talk about that I haven't in previous sponsorship spots is their brick and mortar element. They were predominantly an online company up till more recently, but now they are approaching 100 stores all over the US. My local store is here in Gainesville, Florida, and I've been multiple times. And the discounts you see online are applied also in the stores. So as I mentioned, 5.11 is offering you 15% off every purchase that you make. But I do want to say, more often than not, they have an even deeper discount, especially around holiday times. But if you use the code SHIELD15, that's SHIELD15, you will get 15% off your order or in the stores every time you make a purchase. And if you want to hear more about 5.11, who they stand for and who works with them, listen to episode 580 of Behind the Shield podcast with 5.11 regional director, Will Ayers. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome back onto the show author Johan Hari. Now, for those of you who listened to episode 317, we took a deep dive into his books Chasing the Scream and Lost Connections, discussing mental health and addiction. Well, Johan has a brand new book called The Magic Pill, where he details his own experience with the weight loss drug Ozempic. And as you will hear, we dive into a host of topics, from the psychology behind obesity, how these drugs have the potential to replace gastric bypass surgery, thus making weight loss much safer, deconstructing the health of the food in our stores, some incredible ideas from overseas, and so much more. Now, before we get to this amazing conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 900 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Johan Hari. Enjoy. Well, Johan, I want to start by saying I am so, so glad to get you back on the show. We were just talking before we hit record. Ironically, I tried reaching out several times, and as people will hear in these conversations, there are reasons why you're away from your devices. But you have already had one great book out, Stolen Focus. You're about to release Magic Pill. So I just want to start by welcoming you back onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Oh, I'm so glad to be with you. Cheers, James.
So the last time we sat down was May 30th, 2020. An interesting time in the last few years. So.
Can't remember anything that happened in between now and then, you know. Sure, there were some world events, I forget.
I believe so. Actually, I was listening. I wish I could remember the name. There was a podcast you did, I think it was recently, with three Australian hosts.
Oh, the Imperfects. I love those guys.
Yeah,
they're great.
Great, great conversation, especially for three of them. They weren't interrupting or stepping over each other.
Brothers.
But one of them was telling a story. I forget who it was they said now. But someone went into it was Jared Leto, went into a meditation retreat right before COVID hit, and then came out 30 days later wondering what the hell had happened to the world because he'd been in some monastery for a month.
Yeah, I was in Vegas for a lot of COVID because I'm writing a book about a series of crimes that are happening in Vegas. I've been researching them for God, 13 years now. I've got, it's the next book in the queue. It's the next one I'm going to write. And Vegas was an absolute headfuck during COVID. It was completely bizarre. There was a period when everything shut down. So Steve Sisolak, the governor, shut everything down a few weeks into the pandemic. But so in Vegas, if you've got a gaming license, by law, you have to be open 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. You can never close, right? I think you're allowed by law to close for like 6 hours a year to for cleaning, and that's it, right? So there was this bizarre thing where when everything had to shut down, no one had any keys to lock the doors. Like Caesar's Palace opened in 1966 and has never closed, right? So there was this sudden bizarre, like, anyone seen those keys since 1966? It was completely surreal. There was also a period when it reopened when they were very strict on the mask mandates in Vegas. This period where it reopened, where the strip clubs reopened, where it looked like it was going to be that there would be strippers and the only thing they would be wearing was going to be face masks because by law they had to, right? So it was a completely surreal. I mean, it was surreal everywhere, but I think it was Vegas always gives an extra surreal edge to everything in life.
Absolutely. Well, while we're on that topic, just for a second, Chasing the Scream, an incredible book on addiction. I actually just sat back down with Zhao Gulao a few months ago for our second interview.
Oh, I love Zhao. Yeah. What a great man.
Amazing.
And one of the most impressive people I've ever met. Yeah. A really great man.
And so humble as well. But then you have the obviously Lost Connections. Now, we all know what happened and the way it was handled during the pandemic. The way I navigated those years is I put lots and lots of extra episodes out on health, nutrition, mental health, etc. So people had autonomy in their homes. They had actionable things to do, even though they were being told to, you know, stay in your house and we'll tell you what to do. That time is already gone. And we had a captive audience and an amazing opportunity to really move the needle on a lot of wellness issues. And they just didn't. So rather than being critical of that time, with all the areas that you've written about up to this point, if everyone listened today, what were the lessons that you wish people had learned from the last 4 years if they were listening right now?
Well, everyone knows they have natural physical needs. You need food, you need water, you need shelter, you need clean air. If I took those things away from you, you'd be in real trouble real fast. But there's equally strong evidence that all human beings have natural psychological needs. You need to feel you belong. You need to feel your life has meaning and purpose. You need to feel that people see you and value you. You need to feel you've got a future that you understand and that makes sense. And our culture is great at many things. I'm glad to be alive today, but we've been getting less and less good at meeting these deep underlying psychological needs for a very long time, throughout my lifetime, in fact. And then obviously during the pandemic, the ability to get your psychological needs met just collapsed. You know, we had to physically separate because of the virus. There's a massive increase in loneliness. We were already the loneliest society in human history. They had a huge increase in loneliness, huge increase in stress, a huge increase in people not having a sense they understood the future or had a future. So I think what it shows us is that being deprived of your underlying psychological needs makes you feel terrible, right? It makes you feel anxious, it makes you feel depressed, or at the very least, it makes you feel much less good than you otherwise would have. And there's all sorts of ways that I write about in my book, Lost Connections, that I saw being played out all over the world, that we can together change the way we're living to get our deeper needs met. And when you do that, it reduces depression and anxiety massively. It's not the only thing you can do to reduce depression. There are many things that I talk about in the book, but and that people will know about. But yeah, so I guess the main thing is, you know, someone wrote to me, a friend of mine, Andrew Sullivan, the writer, wrote to me at the height of COVID when it had just been reported that depression had doubled in Britain. And he said, it's like we ran an experiment to see if you were right. You know, if your book was correct, right? Now, there were bigger things going on in the world than worrying about whether I was right or not. But I think there's a truth in that, that, you know, the book is called Lost Connections because we've lost our connections to many of the things you need in life. And in the pandemic, we lost our connections even more. And it was a disaster. Now, of course, there was a good reason for us to physically separate during the pandemic, right? But that can teach us something going forward. Okay, if massive increase in loneliness and stress and anxiety and loss of a sense of the future was making us feel terrible during the pandemic, well, that might help us understand why depression and anxiety were hugely rising before the pandemic, and why since the pandemic, if we want to get out of this spiraling depression and anxiety and addiction, which has very similar causes, the core of addiction is about not wanting to be present in your life because your life is too painful a place to be. If we want to get out of that spiral, we've got to do many things, but one of them is we've got to deal with the deep underlying causes of these problems, right? Which can sound very fancy, but like I say, I went to places that have done it. I've seen how it's done in practice.
Absolutely. I remember quoting you many times when it came to hearing about all the mental health elements, you know, from the pandemic. And again, ultimately, it was about resilience. And so what should have happened is that we should have fought to make the people in our own nations as healthy as possible and as happy as possible, because the more scared and isolated they are, the less resilient they are, the more immunocompromised they are, therefore the higher chance there is of having a greater response to the virus. So when you talk about, you know, the opposite of the addiction isn't sobriety, the opposite of addiction is connection. Well, during the pandemic, alcohol didn't get stronger. People just connected less. So I think, again, underlining your work, this is what I think really needed to be brought out of this whole thing, is we've got to make people healthier, because another thing is going to come. But also we've got to understand, exactly like you said, that the disconnection, the pigeonholing and dividing of communities and countries only further adds fuel to the fire of addiction, depression, you know, suicide, homelessness, and all the other things that we see, you know, crushing our men, women, and children.
Well, you know, there's a wonderful couple called Professor Anne Case and Professor Angus Dayton, who've done some of the best work looking at the places where addiction is highest in the United States. And I've been to a lot of them, mostly for my research. And they describe those deaths as deaths of despair. And as you know, we had a lot of addiction in my family, so this really rings true to me. You know, and interestingly, I've been thinking about these issues in a very different way about health in the last, you know, year, because I've been writing a book about these new weight loss drugs that have come along. And I've been spent a year kind of traveling all over the world, taking these drugs, interviewing the leading experts on them, the scientists who play key roles in designing them and making them possible, their biggest critics, their biggest supporters, all over the world, from, you know, Reykjavik in Iceland to Minneapolis to Tokyo. And it's been so interesting because, you know, with my previous books, which we've talked about, you know, I ended up with a very strong sense of this is what we should do now. I went to places that I felt had found the answer. Of course, there's a lot we don't know, but, you know, a huge sense of this is the way forward. This is what we should do. With these weight loss drugs, it's been really interesting. The subtitle of the book is The Extraordinary Benefits and Disturbing Risks of the New Weight Loss Drugs. And right from when I first heard about these drugs, and I can tell you how it happened, the moment I first heard about them, because it was kind of a weird experience, but right from the moment I heard about them, I don't remember ever feeling so conflicted about a subject. You know, I could see the argument for them. The scientific evidence is very clear that obesity very seriously harms your health on average, and these drugs reverse obesity for lots of people, and that has incredible positive effects. You know, if you take these drugs over the next, and you started off obese, you're in the next 5 years, you're 20% less likely to have a heart attack or stroke, for example. And that's just one of the many health benefits. And I could see, you know, we've been torturing ourselves with diets for years. God knows I have. Someone whose weight has always yo-yoed from like underweight to obese throughout my adult life. And I kind of thought, well, if there's a solution here, if there's something you can do that's relatively painless and that reverses obesity, wow, this could be amazing. And lots of the scientists I spoke to really reinforced that. They were like, no, this is a game changer. One of them described it as said, we found the holy grail, right? We found a drug that reliably and safely causes weight loss. But there were other scientists, and honestly, my own opinion at the start, I thought, well, you know, I felt very anxious. Every previous miracle diet drug has been announced in similar ways and then pulled from the shelves because it caused some horrific effect that meant that it had to be removed, usually in a hail of lawsuits. So I was very conscious of that. But even more, I was conscious, look, there's been a massive increase in obesity just in my lifetime, right? Extraordinary increase. The average American weighs 23 pounds more than they did shortly before I was born, right? That's an extraordinary increase, unprecedented in human history. In the world, obesity has tripled since 1975. And it didn't increase because there was some biological problem that needed to be fixed with a medicine. It increased because the food supply changed in ways that have really fucked us up and made us sick, right? And of course, I thought, well, you know, my books are all about, we've got to deal with the causes of problems. It's what we were just saying in relation to, you know, the what COVID has revealed about depression and addiction. I kind of thought, well, we've got to deal with the causes of this problem. Isn't this just sort of treating the symptom in what could potentially be a very risky way? So I ended up all the way through the book having to very carefully weigh the benefits and the risks of these drugs. And there are a lot of benefits and there are 12 quite big risks that I go through in the book. And then lots of implications for these drugs in all sorts of directions. You know, Barclays Bank commissioned a very sober-minded financial analyst called Emily Field to go away and give them guidance for investors on what these drugs are going to mean for investors, right? The kind of investments people should be making. And she came back and said, if you want a comparison for something similar in terms of its effect on the economy and the society, you've got to look back to the invention of the smartphone in 2007, right? This is going to have massive effects on our society. We've now got a drug that causes you to lose 15% of your body weight on average over a year. In fact, that's just Ozempic / Wegovy. The next generation, Mounjaro, which is also now available, causes 21% body weight loss on average. And the next generation to come down the line, Triple G, that will probably be available next year, causes 24.2% body weight loss after a year. I mean, that's only slightly less than bariatric surgery. This is going to be massive for good, for bad. It's something we really need to, in my view, deeply, deeply think about and reckon with.
When you talk about bariatric surgery, I'm sitting here now, my wife's in the other room, and she lost her best friend just over a year ago. And the kind of, I would say the cascade of ill health began with bariatric surgery. There's a guy I went to fire school with who had complications of bariatric surgery, and he was way back 10 years younger than me when I went to school, I think. And he lost a lot of weight as well, and now he's no longer with us.
How did he die, James?
There was something where they ended up, part of his intestine actually started dying, basically, to put it in layman's terms. So they didn't discover until it was too late. And I think he literally, you know, was gone within days of them figuring out what was going on. So, you know, when I think of bariatric surgery, like you said, and the weight loss element of it, that absolutely is a thing. But as you said, there are 12, you know, startling things about these pills. It's the same with bariatric surgery. And it terrifies me because, you know, when you think about what you're doing to the human body, it's extremely unnatural. So,
well, I think that's really important, James, because what bariatric surgery shows in an extreme and heightened form is a dilemma, right? Because why would anyone have bariatric surgery, right? Bariatric surgery is horrific, physically horrific surgery. About 1 in 1,000 people die during the operation. So why would they do it? And the reason why many doctors recommend it for people who are severely obese and have tried other ways and they haven't worked is because bariatric surgery reverses or hugely reduces obesity. And that leads to, for the people who don't die and the people who don't have the horrific complications, and that's a big caveat, but for the people who don't, it leads to staggering improvements in health. So if you have bariatric surgery, over the next 7 years, you're 56% less likely to die of a heart attack. You're 60% less likely to die of cancer. You're 92% less likely to die of diabetes-related causes. And in fact, the effect is so powerful, you're 40% less likely to die of any cause. Now, I'm not waving a flag for bariatric surgery. Bariatric surgery is horrible. I don't think I would do it. But what that shows us, in a very extreme way, is the dilemma, right? Because if you just look at the harms of bariatric surgery, you'd be like, well, this is insane. Why would anyone ever do this, right? You're having part of your stomach removed. I mean, there's different forms of bariatric surgery, but you're having an extraordinarily invasive form of surgery. It's very painful. As I say, not a negligible number of people die during the surgery, 1 in 1,000. Why would you do it? It's because severe obesity is sadly, on average, catastrophic for human health. Now, what these drugs do is they take that dilemma and slightly alter it. Obviously, most people taking these drugs are not severely obese. But, you know, as I say, you've now got these drugs which come with a whole series of risks. But everyone, I think, would agree the risks are significantly less than for bariatric surgery, right? No one is claiming that these drugs kill 1 in 1,000 people. Even their worst critics don't claim that. So what you've got is drugs that and there's a lot of other downsides to bariatric surgery that I think are interesting to think about in relation to these new weight loss drugs as well. Perhaps we can come back to that. But what the good news in that respect is, okay, you're going to be able to get bariatric surgery type weight loss without the operation. I mean, I can't see why once Triple G is available, unless you were someone who, for some reason absolutely couldn't take these drugs. I can't see why anyone would have bariatric surgery once the next generation of the drugs, which have already been tested in clinical trials, are available.
I think what really breaks my heart about these two is neither of them, I would argue, were even probably labeled obese, certainly not severely obese. I mean, one, my wife's friend was just overweight. She was overweight, but not even obese. And then the other one, he might have been scraping it, but he was kind of a big boned lad anyway. So I think this is the problem is, you know, like you said, I agree. If I have been on literally a 1,000-pound patient when I was working as a firefighter paramedic, that was the pancake on the bed that we see in the reality shows. That gentleman, who I'm sure is no longer with us now, that would be his only option, lying in a bed, not able to move. The only thing that maybe, you know, would save his life. But just like cesarean sections with pregnancy, now fast forward in America in 2024, you know, oh, I'd like to have my baby on Tuesday at 7:30 in the morning, please. All right, yeah, we'll just slice you open and off you go. Right, and that's, to me, is an abuse of that surgery. C-sec is absolutely pertinent in certain areas. You know, there's a dangerous birth or, you know, very, very petite mother, and that, you know, that application is warranted. But we have allowed it to devolve to, you know, all these C-sec births now, they're not getting the, you know, the bacteria that the baby should be getting from a vaginal birth. And so that's, I think, what really I struggle with is, as a last resort, I understand bariatric, but I don't think it's being used like that in 2024.
I mean, the good thing is that that dilemma is, people aren't going to be worrying about that dilemma in a couple of years because of the extraordinarily potent effect of these drugs. And I think it's worth thinking about how these drugs work. And we now know much more even than we did a year ago about how these drugs work. So when you eat, you get a, so let's say you had a meal now while we were talking, your gut would release a hormone called GLP-1. And that is one of the natural signals in your body that would just say, James, you've had enough, stop eating, right? Just stop now. And most people, when they get that signal, they do stop. But that signal only remains in your body naturally for less than 10 minutes. It washes away. So if you kind of power through it, you can carry on eating, and obviously then you'll overeat, right? So what these drugs do, and I interviewed the scientists who made all the breakthroughs that made this possible, is they're mostly not pills at the moment, they're mostly injections. They inject into your system a copy of GLP-1, a kind of artificial replica of it. But instead of being washed out of your system in 10 minutes, it stays in your body for a whole week, which means that, I can tell you from my own experience, when you start eating, you know, remember the couple of days after I started taking Ozempic, I woke up and I had this weird feeling. I wake up and thinking, what do I feel? There's something strange here. And I lay there for like 5 minutes and I couldn't place it. And then I realized, oh, I'm not hungry. Right. My whole life, I don't remember a day when I didn't wake up hungry. Right. I would often be woken up by my stomach rumbling. And I woke up and I wasn't hungry. I thought, oh, this is a bit weird. And I went to the cafe up the road from here where I used to always go for breakfast. And I ordered my standard breakfast, which was a chicken roll with lots of mayonnaise, a brown bread, huge roll with lots of mayo. and I had a couple of bites, you know, a little bit. So, you know, I had maybe three or four bites, which is quite a lot when it's a big thing. And then I just felt full. It was the strangest sensation. And I left. I remember Tatiana, the Brazilian woman who runs the cafe, sort of saying, "Are you sick, Johan? Are you okay?" And then I went for lunch to this Turkish restaurant I used to go to for lunch most days up the road next to my office, which, and I had my standard order, which was the Mediterranean lamb. And again, had like a third of what I would normally have. And then I just wasn't hungry. And it was like the kind of shutters had come down on my appetite. So one of the things these drugs do is they make you fuller, faster. We now know, it used to be thought that was primarily because of an effect on your gut and your stomach. It's not. It's primarily because of an effect on your brain, which I'm sure we can explore and talk about. But I was fascinated by how rapid the transformation was in my appetite. There were certainly unpleasant side effects as well. But I remember just being really quite shocked by how dramatic the effect was on my appetite and how rapid the weight loss was, right? I've lost 3 stone in just over a year. I'm terrible at converting to pounds, so I need to memorize this before some of the other interviews. But what's that 3 stone in pounds for American listeners?
46, I think. 46 pounds.
46, something like that. Yeah, yeah. So it's a huge amount of weight loss. I was 14 and a half stone when I started. I'm 11 and a half now. And actually, and I'm unusual in this respect, all of my weight loss has been fat. I was 33% body fat when I started. I'm now, I haven't done it in about a month, but I was, I think it was 23 when I last checked. So, you know, I've gone from 33, which is only slightly below the body fat composition of a whale, to, I gained a lot of weight during COVID, like a lot of people, to now, you know, in the BMI charts, I'm in the nice soothing green zone, the middle of the slightly upper end of the green zone, which is a nice place to be.
42 pounds, I correct myself. I'm not good at doing maths on the spot. So,
yeah, spontaneous maths is my my like stress dream. I can,
Well, you touched on, you know, on the effect on their brain as well. Just to reverse engineer for a second, you talked about the kind of yo-yo weight struggles that you had. I think it was an amazing part of, I think it was Chasing the Scream, when you talked about the woman in the weight loss study who was on the IV nutrition and then discovered that she was abused by her grandfather when she was young. And that was a psychological reason for the weight gain. I thought that was such a powerful, you know, anecdote, because we always kind of chastise the overweight. When I say we, some people in the fitness industry, well, if you just, you know, ate salad and go for a run every day, then you'll look like me. And obviously there's a whole psychology behind our eating as well. So when you look back with this lens now at your journey, what psychologically do you think contributed to you struggling with your weight and body dysmorphia?
I wouldn't say I had body dysmorphia, but I definitely didn't. But for obesity, there's 3 kinds of cause, as with many conditions. There's biological causes, there's psychological causes, and there's social causes, right? So biological causes are things like your genes, changes that happen in your brain. Psychological causes are how you feel about yourself and the world. And environmental causes are things like, in this case, the food supply system, right? So I would say all 3 of them in different ways were playing out with me. But you've asked about the psychological ones, so let's home in on that for a sec. And it was one of the strangest things that happened to me during the working on the book, a kind of surfacing of these issues, right? So if you'd asked me when I started working on the book, Magic Pill, if you'd asked me, you know, Johan, why do you eat? I would have said, well, I eat to sustain my body, right? I eat to keep going. Obviously, that's why I eat. But, you know, before I took these drugs, I was eating about 3,200 calories a day. And now I eat about 1,800, sometimes between 1,800 and 2,000 a day. So that's a lot fewer calories, right? So, and here I am, my body is sustained, it's alive. In fact, it's healthier than it was. So something else was going on with a huge amount of my eating. And I looked a lot at the evidence about why people eat, right? And obviously sustenance is the primary, or rather the most important one. But there's lots of other psychological reasons why people eat. One of them is pleasure, right? Huge numbers of people get a lot of pleasure out of food. And one of the issues around these drugs is for a lot of people, not me, I have to say, but I can explain why if you want, but it really strips the pleasure out of foods. For example, there's a British food critic called Jay Rayner, brilliant food critic, who, you know, has talked about, he went on these drugs, he goes to like some of the best restaurants in Paris and just cannot enjoy the food. Even one of the scientists involved in designing the drugs, Jens Jules Holst, said in an interview with Wired magazine that, you know, for a lot of people, they take these drugs and it just strips the pleasure out of food. And after a year or two, life is so boring, they just can't go on. They, I have to say, it didn't have that effect on me, but I don't think for a particularly good reason. One of the things I realized, so I grew up in a working class family and I grew up eating absolute shit, right? Like, I mean, like I ate nothing but junk food for my entire childhood and teenage years. I mean, that's, I don't think that's an exaggeration, right? The day the microwave, I was mostly raised by my grandmother, who was an amazing woman. And the day the microwave was invented was the happiest day of my grandmother's life, right? And it's funny, I remember the first time I took Ozempic. You know, like a lot of people when they're about, a lot of people who've nearly died and, you know, been revived, describe near-death experiences. I feel like I had a sort of near-death experience with food where I could picture all the food I'd ever, as I was injecting myself, I was pictured all the food I'd ever eaten in my life, right? And I pictured, you know, so much shit, like so many, like, you know, there's little foam sugary bananas you used to get when you were a kid. I pictured like loads of just in staggering amounts of KFC and McDonald's. There's 38,000 branches of McDonald's in the world, and I felt like I could see them all flicking through my mind. And I realized when it comes to pleasure, partly because I grew up in a very violent and crazy environment when I wasn't with my grandmother, for me, the primary pleasure I got from food was actually from kind of stuffing myself. I wouldn't have thought about it this way, but looking back, I would sort of deliberately overeat. So everyone will have been stuffed at some point in their life, Thanksgiving dinner or something, you know, and stuffing is a particular kind of pleasure. It is a kind of physical pleasure when you're stuffed. It's uncomfortable, but it's also pleasurable. You know, it's where you can feel sort of a pressure outwards on your stomach and upwards on your esophagus. And I think most of the pleasure I got from food was sort of stuffing. I would overeat to stuff myself. And when I was on Ozempic, I couldn't, you can't really do that when you're on Ozempic. You would just throw up if you did that. So for me, I actually had to slow down my eating when I started taking these drugs, which actually for me meant that I kind of tasted my food a bit more. And actually, I think I enjoy food slightly more. I don't want to claim I'm some great foodie now. I'm never going to be that guy, but I think I've actually had an increase in pleasure from food, admittedly from a very low base. Of course, if you're someone like Jay Rayner, the food critic, it's coming from a different direction with a different relationship with food, he's going to have a different experience. And I think more people are like Jay than they are like me, I suspect, on these drugs. But so that's one thing is pleasure. But another thing, which is a big thing that we're playing out for loads of people, is just comfort. We eat to comfort, to stabilize our emotions, to lift our moods if we're feeling down. There's lots of evidence about this. You know, there's a brilliant study of 475 NFL games, and it found that if the home team wins in a town, sales of shitty junk food go down by 9% in that town over the following week. And if they, they go down if they win. And if they lose, the sales in shitty, comforting junk food go up by 16%, right? So this is true of all traumatic events. There was a massive increase in shitty junk food after 9/11. There was a massive increase in shitty junk food purchases in blue states after Trump won. So comfort eating is a very common thing. If you lose your job, you're very likely to gain a lot of weight, partly through a big increase in comfort eating. And of course, that's another thing that's taken away when these drugs kick in, right? Your ability to comfort eat is much more limited. I remember one day about 6 months into taking them, probably a bit less actually, I had a bad day. Nothing terrible, like not an awful day, but I had a bad day. And kind of on autopilot, I was in Vegas. I went to KFC, a particularly rough KFC in Vegas that I love. And I remember sitting there with this bucket of fried chicken in front of me, which a year before I would have just eaten on autopilot and felt comforted by. I'm just thinking, shit, I can't eat this, right? Like, I mean, I just literally couldn't eat it. And I remember seeing Colonel Sanders staring down at me from the wall. And it's like he was going, hey, buddy, what happened to my best customer, right? So one of the things that happens when you take these drugs is the underlying psychological components that drive your eating are disrupted and therefore come to the surface. Now, that can be a good or bad thing, right? I remember going to one of my best friends and just saying, yeah, this is making me feel like shit. I can't comfort eat. I'm going to stop taking them. And her saying to me, you know, this isn't creating this issue. These drugs are not creating this issue, right? This is an issue that's there the whole time. What these drugs are doing is making it visible to you. So yeah, you can stop taking the drugs and go back to that, and you'll incur all sorts of health costs in the long term, and you'll be comforted in the short term. Or you can try to change your relationship. You can try to understand these feelings and change your relationship with food, and try to see food, begin to see food as something you use to feed your body and make you healthy, not something you use primarily to manage your emotions. And that's what I decided to do. And I think it was a very conscious effort, and it's been hard work, but I think I've made a huge amount of progress in that. I did notice when I was writing the book, I kept mistyping fried chicken as friend chicken. And I thought, God, you don't need to be Freud to figure out that one, right? But yeah, so I would say to anyone who's thinking about taking these drugs, think about your relationship with food, because whatever your emotional relationship with food is, these drugs will lay it bare in ways that can be quite challenging and ultimately, for many people, quite positive.
That's really interesting to hear. I'm so glad that we went down that road, because when I listen to that, it reminds me of a Dutch model I had on, Dorothy Mouse. And she was an alcoholic and then ended up, you know, literally like cold turkeying her sobriety. And she made a comment. It's like, when you are sober, you have to face all your emotions. You know, I mean, that's a very obvious statement, but it's also very pertinent, because I mean, I went to this ball with my wife last night, and you know, I drank. So I'm always very, very clear about my reliance on alcohol in some areas. I don't binge drink or anything, but I drink frequently. But when you remove that crutch, and you wouldn't have thought of that for a weight loss drug, but the way you've described it, when you remove that crutch, and you hopefully couple it with an understanding of the toolbox that you actually have at your disposal to start unpacking what it is that's behind the eating, that then becomes another positive element of this drug that I wouldn't have thought of before.
Yeah, and I think, so most people who take these drugs, it seems, experience a improvement in health, and I really needed that. You know, I'm older now than my grandfather ever got to be. I'm 45. He died when he was 44 of a heart attack. My dad had bad heart problems. My uncle died of a heart attack. You know, I was conscious that, particularly with my family's history, it would be a very bad idea to carry on carrying excess weight, given the overwhelming evidence about heart disease and weight gain. For every 3.6 inches you gain on your waist, you increase your chances of having a heart attack by 27%. It's a big increase. So I was very kind of conscious of that. And most people experience a kind of boost in health. There does seem to be a significant minority who are experiencing distress, right? And I think there's a range of reasons why. So in fact, there's even a much debated safety signal around suicide. So a safety signal is where doctors notice that some of their patients who were on a particular drug appear to be getting a particular reaction. And so some doctors notice that some of their patients appear to be developing suicidal feelings after taking these drugs. So they raised a signal about it. Now, most safety signals turn out to be nothing, just like most times your smoke alarm goes off, your house is not on fire. So that the fact there's a safety signal doesn't mean that it's happening. But there's a big, big debate about this. And the FDA requires a warning on these drugs that it may cause suicidal ideations. The European Medicines Agency is looking into it. Now, that would be for a small minority. Stress, that's important. But obviously, it's a big risk for a small minority. And there's a big debate about why that might be. So some of it might be the psychological components that we've just talked about. Some of it may be something else, which I spent a lot of time discussing with the leading scientists who are doing some of the kind of cutting edge research on this, which is when these drugs were first developed, people thought, oh, this is a gut hormone. We're injecting people with the simulation of a gut hormone. These drugs are mainly having an effect on your gut. They must be slowing down gastric emptying and all sorts of other things, right? And they do indeed clearly have an effect on the gut. But there is a growing scientific consensus that, in fact, these drugs primarily do not work through an effect on your gut, real though the effect is. They primarily work on your brain. So it was discovered that in your brain, it was discovered by scientists here in London at Hammersmith Hospital, that in your brain, you have GLP-1 receptors. So GLP-1 is that hormone that the drug simulates. You don't just have receptors for it in your gut. You have them in your mouth, in your thyroid, and in your, most crucially, in your brain. And so when you tag Ozempic, for example, and then you give it to an animal, and then you cut open the animal's brain to see where it went. You obviously can't do this with humans, but if you do it with an animal, a non-human animal, what you see is that the drug goes everywhere in the brain, right? As Professor Robert Kushner said to me, this drug goes everywhere in the brain. This affects everything in the brain, right? It seems to affect some brain regions most importantly. And slightly disconcertingly, scientists do not really understand what the brain effect is yet, right? So there's different theories, and I go through the different theories and I'm happy to talk about them because they all have potentially different risks and benefits. But when you take these drugs, you are taking a drug that changes your brain. And that feels like a deeper change and a more potentially disturbing one. It may help explain some of the extraordinary benefits as well. It's one of the fascinating things about these drugs. The more you look, the more complex and interesting the picture becomes, both biologically, in terms of the effect on the culture, in terms of the effect on your psychology. This is just, I just found this such a fascinating subject with so many weird alleyways and corners and different things that I think we really need to know. And we really need to know this because, you know, there was a poll recently, 47% of Americans want to take these drugs, right? And the price is going to come down relatively soon. I can explain why. That is a staggering number of people who want to take this drug. And, you know, due to the staggering levels of obesity and overweight in the United States, very recent problem, you know, very recent, essentially it's in my lifetime that the obesity crisis has happened. It essentially did not exist prior to my lifetime or ever in human history. So you might even be thinking, well, I'm not really interested in these drugs for myself. Okay, but go back to what that Barclays analyst said, you know, comparing it to the birth of the smartphone. In 2007, you might not have wanted to have a smartphone either, the year Steve Jobs launched it. But the iPhone changed the society all around you, even if you never bought one, right? If we were talking in 2007, we could never have predicted the effects on attention or Trump or TikTok or anything, that all the crazy different things that flowed from the invention of the iPhone. And this is going to really revolutionize our societies in complex ways. And I think we can begin to see some of the threads of how this is going to affect us now. And we're going to see it more and more as time goes by.
What is the philosophy, and it might be different in different countries as you're having this conversation with people, on the prescription of these meds? And the reason I ask that, I am a huge believer in the body's incredible innate ability to heal. So for example, you know, if someone has the psychological ability to really dive into a plant-based diet for 6 months, you know, I truly believe that they would see their blood chemistry improve, you know, some of the inflammation in the body would improve. Do they need to be on that the rest of their life? Of course not. But you're giving the body all the tools it needs to start healing itself, and you're removing all the toxins and carcinogens and, you know, processed foods that were causing the issue in the first place. When, as a firefighter and a paramedic, I see a lot of people here in the US, which is what I know now, what I see, and even in my fellow firefighters, is, oh, you've got high blood pressure. You're going to be on this the rest of your life. Here's a statin. Here's a, you know, beta blocker, whatever it is. And so there's not an application of a medication being used simply as a bridge between where you are and where we want you to be through exercise, diet, sleep, meditation, etc. So I see with these pills as a phenomenal application of, all right, Stephanie or Steve, you're at this weight now. you're at this body composition, we're worried about these things, you know, these disease processes. We're going to give, you know, a 2-year plan to get you with this pill down to here. But then we're also going to work on getting you off the pill. And now hopefully, you know, getting you to the point where you can self-stabilize with a healthy, holistic diet. What worries me with any application of pharmaceuticals in a profit-based system like America is economically, you want people to be taking your pills the rest of their life. So what have you seen as far as the nuances in different countries with the application of this incredible medication?
I think there's a few different questions in there, and you raised some really interesting points, James. So I would start with that question about how long do you need to take them for? So I noticed with myself, the first 6 months I was taking them, to put it crudely, I was eating smaller portions of the same shit. Right. So I would, you know, go to the same place that I always went, but I would eat a little bit, you know, and that's clearly was an improvement, right? As we see from the fact that I lost loads of weight and all sorts of health indicators improved. But it didn't feel like I was. Well, one of the things we don't know is whether you develop tolerance to these drugs, right? So it's possible. If you look at, for example, there are 60-month, the longest term studies we have go a little bit longer than 60 months. And if you look at the graph of weight loss over 60 months, basically a bit more than 60 months, basically what happens is you lose an enormous amount of weight. Then you plateau, you stop losing weight, which is, of course, what we'd want. You wouldn't want a drug that would make people literally waste away. The plateau has to happen. And then at the very end of the 60 months, it starts to slightly tick up again. Now, I want to be clear, it's ticking up a little bit. So you're still vastly lower than you were at the start. And then the studies stop. And the studies were always designed to stop at that point. But nonetheless, you're a bit like, oh, what's going on there? And as with so many things in relation to these drugs, the scientists involved just do not agree on the question of tolerance. So some scientists said to me, well, it does seem quite likely there'll be some tolerance that will be developed. Some drugs people never develop tolerance to. Antihistamines, for example, you can take them your whole life, you'll never develop tolerance to them. So there's a debate about that. The biggest argument that we won't develop tolerance is that diabetics have been taking these drugs now for more than 18 years because they, in addition to having these the effects we've been talking about, GLP-1 in your pancreas stimulates the creation of more insulin. So obviously for diabetics, it's great. Both type 1 and type 2 diabetics. So they've been taking them for 18 years and they don't seem to be developing tolerance. If they were developing tolerance, they would need higher and higher doses to achieve the same benefits for their blood sugar. And that isn't happening. So, I mean, it could be that it has different effects for diabetes compared to obesity. There's a big debate about this. But all of which is to say, given that we don't know that about tolerance, we don't know yet about tolerance, it's possible that this is just opening a window of change that will close, right? That eventually the effects of the drug will wear off. In which case, there's a strong case for doing what you're saying. And even if there isn't tolerance, there's a strong case for doing what you're saying because there are significant risks to taking any drug, and particularly a drug where we don't know the long-term effects. And actually, there are some effects we do know that we should be worried about in relation to these drugs that I'm sure we'll talk about. So given that, yeah, it makes most sense to do what you're saying, which is use it as an opportunity to interrupt your unhealthy patterns and build a load of change into your life. So I did that to some degree. I'm still taking the drug, but you know, I learned how to cook. Embarrassingly, I was in the middle of my 40s. I'd never learned how to cook. I started learning how to dance, which is really good fun, it turns out. I made all sorts of changes in my own life. So what we know about when you stop is at the moment, the studies that look at when you stop, and we should stress these studies are funded by the drug companies who have a vested interest in encouraging people to take the drugs forever. So take them with a pinch of salt, but they were done by reputable scientists. What those studies found is if you take the drugs, lose weight, and then stop taking the drugs, you regain 70% of the weight you've lost within a year. It's a pretty dramatic effect, right? Now, what those studies didn't look at is, well, what if you combine them with lifestyle changes and all sorts of other things, right? And I suspect, although I don't know this, I can't prove this, that the people who didn't regain the weight, you know, in those studies made some other changes, right? I suspect that's what happened. It seems like common sense. So yeah, that's a kind of a broad overview in terms of different countries. So different countries are more strict or more relaxed about how easily you can get these drugs. So in Australia at the moment, you can only get them if you've got diabetes. In Britain, you can get it for obesity, but you, in theory, at least, you're meant to be have a BMI over than 27, which is wouldn't actually even be obese. That's overweight. And you've got to see a doctor and, you know, all sorts of things. In the US, it's pretty lax. I mean, as I say, I'm in Vegas a lot of the time. You can basically go to any beauty spa in Vegas and get a compounded version of these drugs. They don't really check anything. I suspect if I went in and I was bone thin and I asked for it, they would give it to me. I mean, I had actually started taking it in Britain and I had to get it a few times in Vegas. And I went in. By the time I went in, because I'd taken the drug and I'd lost a load of weight, I was not obese. If I had been at that weight when I was starting, the clinical guidance is to not take the drug, right? Obviously, I was taking it to maintain that lower weight, which a clinical guidance does allow. And they didn't ask me anything. I don't care. Give a shit, right? They also charge you an absolute fortune in the US. In Britain, you pay £200 a month, which is what, about $260, something like that. In the US, it's like $800 to $1,200 a month. Different countries are adopting different strategies with different risk levels, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, we won't dive into this too deeply, but, you know, I'm a huge fan of the philosophy of the national health system. I mean, I really am. I think that everyone chipping in to take care of the people who need it at that time is, in my opinion, the most Christian, Hindu, you know, whatever philosophy you subscribe to, it's the most kind, compassionate way to do it. Take care of everyone, just like you would in an ancient tribe. I don't think they were asking for insurance cards in, you know, the Incas back in the day when Inca Steve got sick and needed, you know, attention. So I love that philosophy. And I always,
I mean, to be fair, the Incas are probably not the best example because they probably were sacrificing them to the
Maybe that's what it was. Yeah, Steve was sick, so we cut his head off.
But yeah, I get your point. Yeah, the wider point you're making is what I totally agree with.
And I try and get people to understand, like, when you have a profit-based system, just economically at its base, you want your customers to keep buying. So where are the checks and balances for making the nation healthy? If the NHS was run the way it really is supposed to, the taxpayer makes, you know, contributes a certain amount, the absolute emphasis should be on making the British as healthy as possible so we use as little taxpayers' money. And then the elderly, the, you know, the newborns, whatever group that needs our money collectively, we have the facilities, the beds, the doctors, the nurses for them. This is a kind of interesting segue because I want to get your take on this. I moved to the US 22 years ago now, and it breaks my heart because I feel like every time I go home, my, you know, original countrymen and women and children seem to be getting more and more overweight and obese, something that I don't remember seeing when I was young. And if you did, it was an anomaly, really. What have you seen as far as the UK specifically and the overweight / obesity epidemic?
Well, the year I was, how old are you, James?
I am about to be 50 on Friday.
Oh, wow, you're looking good for it. So you're slightly older than me. I'm 45. So I was born in 1979. Year I was born, 6% of British people were obese. It's now 26%. It's a staggering increase, literally unprecedented, not just in the history of this country, but the entire history of the human species. And we know, and interestingly, the answer to this question is key to understanding something at the heart of these drugs. So we know why this happened. And there's an experiment that I think distills it down. There's a brilliant guy called Professor Paul Kenny, who is from Dublin in Ireland. Is this brilliant neuroscientist. He's now the head of the Department of Neuroscience at Mount Sinai in New York. And Professor Kenny moved when he was in his 20s to do his PhD from Dublin to San Diego in California. And within, I think, a year, he gained 30 pounds, right? Quickly noticed, American people eat differently, right? Like, there's different food, you know, a lot more of it, and it seems to work differently, right? And he really was finding it very hard to control what he ate. And he started to wonder if this different American diet with foods that just at the time did not exist in Ireland, like cheesecake, or were extremely rare, if that diet in some way affected your brain and your body to make you eat more. So he designed an experiment, which I have nicknamed Cheesecake Park.
Like very simple park. Experiment.
Exactly. So very simple experiment. You get a load of rats and you raise them in a cage. And the only food source they have is pellets that are based on the kind of natural food, the kind of whole foods that rats evolved to eat over many thousands of years. And they've got way more of these pellets than they could ever possibly eat. In that cage, they'll eat when they're hungry, and then they stop. They never become overweight or obese. They have a kind of nutritional wisdom. When they've got the kind of food that they evolved to eat, they'll eat enough of it to keep their bodies going, and then they just stop and do something else, right? Then he introduced into the cage the American diet. He gave them cheesecake, he gave them Snickers bars, he fried up some bacon. And very quickly, something changed in the rats. The kind of wisdom they had had, knowing when to stop eating, seemed to disappear. He would put down the cheesecake and they would hurl themselves into the cheesecake. And they would like eat their way out of it. They would emerge just absolutely slicked with cheesecake, with their whiskers thick with it. And they would just eat and eat and eat and eat. And very quickly, they were extremely obese. The way he put it to me is within a couple of days, they were physically and psychologically different animals, right? Their all sorts of indicators of poor health were starting to shoot up, and they just did not stop, right? And the whole way they had this junk food, they also had their old diet, but they just shunned it. They just stopped eating it almost entirely. Only 5% of their diet came from the pellets once they had the cheesecake and all this other stuff. And then Paul, Professor Kenny, tweaked the experiment again. In a way that seemed a bit cruel to me as a former junk food addict, he took away all the shitty junk food. And again, they only had the healthy whole foods they'd evolved to have. And he was sure he knew what would happen. What he believed would happen is that they would now eat far more of the pellets. So the junk food would have expanded their appetites. That's not what happened. What happened is once they loved the junk food, they'd eaten it for a long time and it was taken away, it's like they didn't even recognize the old food as food at all. They shunned it, they wouldn't eat it, they just starved. And it was only when they were really literally starving that they started to eat the pellets again, right? Now, to me, this is like a parable about, and there's lots of evidence about this happening to humans. There's Gerald Mand, who's a professor of nutrition at Harvard, who designed the food label that's on all American food, said to me, there is something about the food we're eating that is undermining our ability to know when to stop, right? I actually go through the evidence that there's 7 ways in which processed and ultra-processed food profoundly undermines our ability to know when to stop. And so we become like those rats, right? We stop recognizing healthy food as food and we gorge and gorge. It's funny, Professor Kenny said to me, ever since he did that experiment, he's never been able to eat cheesecake again. He just, every time he looks at it, he just gets this mental picture of the rats, like literally eating their way out of the cheesecake. But so there's, and this really importantly loops us back to the drugs, because there's for a long time, I was researching why we gained weight and the effects of these drugs. And at first I thought, oh, these are kind of, there's obviously a connection at the end, right? But these are sort of parallel lines. They're sort of different topics. But there was a word that kept coming up when I researched both topics. And it's a word we don't often use in everyday English, but it's a word we all know. Satiety, right? So what the feeling of being sated is the feeling of just having had enough and not wanting anymore, right? And we get it with food, we get it with sex, we get it with all sorts of things. You know, you might have, you know, you've just had sex and the hottest person in the world might walk into the room. And you'd be like, oh, I just don't want it right now, right? I mean, I'm sure if Keanu Reeves came in, I would find a way. But, you know, in general, right, we've all had that feeling of being sated. And, you know, you can be sated with food, right? And what this food is doing, this ultra-processed food, and 78% of all the calories consumed on an average day by an average American child come from ultra-processed food, which is horrifying, and certainly would have been true of my childhood. That profoundly undermines your satiety. And what these drugs do is they boost your sense of satiety. In fact, one of the scientists who developed them, played a key role in developing them, Karel LaRue, a South African psychiatrist, said to me what these drugs really are is they're giving you satiety hormones. They're giving you your sense of satiety back, right? And once you see it that way, of course, you begin to see the connection between processed food and these drugs is very clear. As Michael Lowe, who's a professor at Drexel University and one of the leading experts in the world on hunger, put it to me, these drugs are an artificial solution to an artificial problem, right? We could put it differently, a man-made solution to a man-made problem, right? These foods undermine our satiety, and these drugs give us back our satiety, which of course begs the question, why the fuck are we accepting these being the two choices, right? Why aren't we changing the food system so that our kids don't face those choices? And I went to countries that have done that, like Japan. I can talk about how they did it. But yeah, you begin to see what's going on here is deeply connected to the change in food that is very big and very recent. We eat foods that our grandparents would not have recognized as food, right? And this has happened very rapidly. And it's why when you come back to Britain, when we were kids in Britain, obesity was very rare. Childhood obesity was extremely rare. It's now, you know, not quite the norm, but is very, very common, right? So yeah, that's a huge change in a very short period of time because overwhelmingly, there's a few other factors, but overwhelmingly because of this change in our diet.
Yeah. Yeah. And going back to the NHS, and this is the problem. So the bigger people get, the sicker people get, the more we drain the resources, the more 999 calls there are. I mean, it's all these areas that they're just getting dismantled along with, you know, budget cuts and all those things. And to me, all these conversation, whether it was you and I talking about addiction before or now this, it's the proactive solution and the false economy of, for example, the war on drugs, thinking that we're going to arrest our way out of addiction, you know, all the money wasted there versus like Portugal did, pouring resources into helping people with their mental health challenges in the first place and job creation, all these things. It's the same with this. And this is what was so disgusting about COVID is we came out, and I don't know how it was in the UK, but here in the US, there was no boosting of PE programs. There were no real food being cooked in schools again and getting rid of soda machines. And we didn't do anything to fix this crisis. We just furthered it. What's interesting about the obesity crisis, and I've heard people say this phrase before as well, is that we are overfed yet malnourished. And so I think one of the other maybe underlying elements that a lot of people have when they keep eating is I wonder, and this is just simply my hypothesis, is the body also still craving nutrition and say, no, you got to keep eating.
I go through, there's really good evidence for this. There's a brilliant guy called Professor David Raubenheimer, who's at the University of Sydney, who's done really important work on this. I interviewed him. So he came up with this theory. So actually, I should say before that, one of the things we know, and there's loads of evidence for that, is that processed and ultra-processed food contains far less protein than whole foods, right? It's really chronically lacking in protein, partly because of the nature of food processing, right? This processed and ultra-processed food is assembled in factories, right? From chemical components, many of which are disgusting when you look into them. Almost everyone listening has eaten an artificial flavoring called vanillin in the last week. It's one of the most common products in our food. Vanillin is a fake form of vanilla. It's in loads of food we eat that is made out of petrochemicals and sawdust. It's pretty gross when you look at it. But Professor Raubenheimer developed this theory. So obviously we are hungry for food in general, right? No surprises there. But also we need protein, right? We need protein to build our bones. It's essential for all sorts of things. And he began to wonder, does the fact that we are lacking in protein, that this food we're eating is lacking in protein, mean that we overeat to get the amount of protein we have? So his kind of theory was, what if we don't just have a hunger for calories in general, but we have a hunger for protein in particular? And if we don't get enough protein, we'll eat more and more until we've got enough protein. And he designed a series of experiments which proved that that is in fact the case, right? That if you're eating food that's low in protein, you'll eat much more of it to get the daily amount of protein that you need for your body to function and for your bones to function. So you're absolutely right. If you're eating food that is chronically lacking in key nutrients, your body will make you eat more of it to at least get up to some level of those nutrients that you need. It's one of the seven reasons that I go through in Magic Pill for why processed food and ultra processed food make us overeat so much.
Yeah, I think this is the thing. I talk about this quite a bit as well. Again, with that kind of, why don't you just get up at five, go for a run and eat a salad kind of, you know, rhetoric that's out there is, say you grew up in, you know, the Bronx or somewhere and the local, you know, park is just a concrete basketball court and, you know, you've only got bodegas around you. That's a very different environment than I grew up. I grew up on a farm in England, you know, but we had vegetables and we had animals on, you know, that we would butcher. And so my understanding of food as a young English boy in 1980s was very, very different. If I wanted an apple, I went to the orchard and grabbed one off the tree. I knew what it was and where I could get it, and it wasn't sprayed with chemicals. And so we have created an environment for failure the same way in addiction, you know, the same way. I mean, this multi-generational trauma and the way that we view mental health and addiction and the gang membership and all these things, we have created an environment for people to fail. And I think this is a really important part of this whole conversation. And again, is why it's so disappointing when it was disregarded during COVID is, as you said, I mean, these are tools that we're talking about, you know, with these pills. And it sounds like the application could be extremely promising, but we also have to fix the environment. And if we're not having that food source conversation, then that, as you pointed out, is why you'll gain 70% of it back when you come off the pill.
Well, you've raised a really important thing that's something I was asking myself a lot as I was working on the book and I had to really dig deeply into, which is, you know, so I was learning about the negative health effects of obesity, which are really significant, right? There was one study in Britain that followed 2,500 government bureaucrats over many years. And at the start, the obese people in the study were no more like, when they were younger, were no more likely to develop health problems than the non-obese people. But as the years went on, the obese people were in the end 8 times more likely to develop health problems than the non-obese people, right? For all sorts of reasons that we can go into. So I was learning about that and the risks of continuing to be obese, which I am sure I would have been had I not taken these drugs, versus the risks of obesity. Versus the risks of these drugs, right? Which are really significant. I go through 12 big risks from these drugs in the book that I'm worried about. And they're pretty broad and there's, you know, a mixture of evidence for them. And some of them are really worrying. And when I talked to my friends about it, I remember one night going out for dinner with one of my friends and I ate almost nothing, and him saying, but what the fuck are you talking about, Johan? You keep saying, oh, you're weighing these two sets of risks. Why don't you just choose the third option? Why don't you just lose weight like everyone else? Why don't you just go on a diet, right? And I did a lot of research on this because in my life, I had, you know, many times in my life, I'd gone on diets and I'd often lost a significant amount of weight and then I kind of gained it all back. And I think it's particularly relevant to your podcast because when I was looking at willpower, one thing really stood out to me. I think we would all agree that firefighters have staggering levels of willpower. There's nothing in the world that could make me run into a burning building, right? And I'm sure most people are like me. Nothing, maybe if someone I loved was there and, you know, it was the only thing. But short of that, you could not get me to run into a burning building.
What if Keanu Reeves is in that building?
A shirtless Keanu Reeves, as he was in the film Speed, crying my name. All right, you've thought of the second scenario, but it's got to be Speed, Keanu, right? Or possibly Point Break, Keanu. But anyway, so I think we'd all agree firefighters have unusually high levels of willpower. And yet also, as you'll know better than me, firefighters are disproportionately more likely to be overweight and obese, right? So if just having high levels of willpower protected you, that would make no sense, right? Because they've definitely got willpower and yet they're more likely to be overweight than the general population. So I think we've got to think about willpower in a slightly different way. Willpower is very real, right? Willpower is a real phenomenon. There's lots of scientific evidence for it. And everyone in their lives will have experienced willpower, right? But the way I began to think about willpower when I looked at the evidence for it in the relation to weight at the moment is I think willpower is a bit like having a pretty strong umbrella in a really, really bad storm, right? Some people using that umbrella are going to be able to get through the storm and get where they're going and not get soaking wet, right? But for most people, the storm is so bad, it'll just break the umbrella and they're going to get soaked, right? So willpower is real, but it exists in a context that is beyond your will, right? So I think it becomes clearer if you look at some of the science around dieting, for example. So there's a very simple fact about dieting that is you have to dispute the rules of physics in order to dispute. If you consume fewer calories than you burn, you will lose weight, right? So you hear that and you're like, oh, the answer's obvious, right? And it's true. It will work if you can do that. But I spent a lot of time interviewing a brilliant woman called Professor Tracy Mann, who's at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. Actually, we met in a bakery called Buns Inn. And the first thing that happened, I was there before her. First thing that happened is I walked in, they said, have you been here before? I said, no. They said, here's a free cinnamon bun. The cinnamon bun, like, absolutely caked in sugar. That must have been like 2,000 calories. And even on the Ozempic, I was able to eat some of it. But Professor Mann has been studying, has done, I think, the most important research on diet in the world, which is why I went to see her. So when she started doing this research in the year 2000, at that time, there were lots of studies of dieting, and the results were very clear. Diets work, right? Use your willpower, eat less, exercise more, you'll lose weight. But she noticed something in these studies. Almost all the studies looked at dieters for 3 months or 6 months, right? So what these studies seem to assume is you lose weight over 3 months or 6 months, and then you just stay at that lower weight for the rest of your life. That didn't seem to fit with most of the people that Tracy, that Professor Mann knew. So she then started to look, well, okay, let's look at the longer term, right? So she started to look for studies of longer term weight loss on diets. And at that time, there were only, I think it was 24 studies that had ever been done that looked at diets, weight loss on a diet over 2 years, or there were a handful of studies that looked at 5 years. And what they found was very different. Almost everyone relapsed when they were dieting, and the average weight loss for a diet after 2 years was 2 pounds. The average person lost 2 pounds. Now, the average is slightly misleading because some people, a very small minority, did lose a lot and keep it off, and we'll all know people like that. But for the vast majority of people, they regain weight over time. And I'm thinking, well, why would that be, right? Even if you stayed on the diet in general, you restricted number of calories, in general, you regained weight. And it turns out that if you gain weight and then lose it, there's strong evidence that a series of biological changes happen in your body that make it really hard to keep that weight off. So one of the ways to understand this is there used to be a theory about weight, which sounds a bit fancy, but it's actually pretty simple to understand, which is called biological set point theory. Basically, what it is they used to think in the 60s and even the 70s that when you were born, your body, or even in the womb, your body has a sort of innate level of body fat that it wants you to be, and it'll basically work really hard to keep you there. You might get a little bit more, you can drop a little bit more, but think about temperature and you start to understand it. Your body has a set point for temperature, right? I think it's whatever it is, 39 degrees centigrade. And your body will work really hard to keep you at that temperature. If you get hotter than that, you'll involuntarily sweat, you'll pant, you'll be really physically uncomfortable. If you get below that, you'll shiver, you'll feel horrible, you know, shivering makes you a bit warmer. So your body works very hard to keep you in that sweet spot of temperature. And it used to be thought that there was something like that for weight, but then the obesity crisis happened. And for a while, the theory just fell apart. They were like, well, obviously that isn't right, because look, how if your body has a set point, how come so many people have gained so much weight so fast? But then actually a lot of the scientists who looked at it figured out you do have a biological set point, but there's a twist. As you gain weight, your set point rises. So let's say you were 11 stone and you go up to 15 stone. Your body will then take that 15 stone weight as your new set point, and it will work very, very hard to keep you at that set point. As Dr. Giles Yeo, who's one of the leading obesity experts at Cambridge University, put it to me, your brain hates it when you lose weight, and it will fight to take you back to the highest weight you could have been. So when you initially lose weight, your brain then fights to bring you back. So how does it do that? It slows down your metabolism. It makes you crave far more sweet, sugary food that would bring your weight back up. It makes you more lethargic, so you want to exercise less. And I remember when I learned this, and there's loads of scientists who put forward evidence for this theory, I remember thinking, well, that doesn't make sense. Why would evolution have equipped us with that, right? Why would evolution give us this thing that makes us so unhealthy? And people like Professor Michael Lowe kept explaining to me, took me a while to get it, you've got to understand the context in which we evolved, right? So in the circumstances where human beings evolved, in fact, in every situation until like 50, 60 years ago, there was no situation where you were going to just have excess abundant calories forever, right? That just never happened. Human beings were never in a situation where they had far more than they could ever eat for their whole lives, right? That, when would that ever happen? So evolution didn't prepare our bodies for that scenario because it didn't ever occur. What evolution did prepare our bodies for was a very different scenario, which happened a lot, which was famine, right? You were very often human beings would have food and then it would go away. And in a situation of famine, the fattest guy at the start of the famine will be the last man standing at the end, right? Timothy Chalamet is going to die very quickly in a and John Candy is going to be the last guy standing, right? So there's, sadly, John Candy no longer with us. That's not a great example, but you know what I mean, right? So actually, there's a huge evolutionary advantage in a situation where famine happens quite often. If you get food, keep consuming it and stay as fat as you can for as long as you can, because sooner or later a famine's going to come along. But what our evolution has done is prepare us for a famine that ain't coming, right? When you and I, barring some horrific event, are never going to be in a situation where there's a famine. What we are in is a situation of calorie excess all the time, or potential calorie excess all the time, right? So you can see how this is a kind of quirk of our biology that has ill-prepared us for this environment. Also leads us back to the drugs, because what some people think, and this is contested, it's certainly not a settled scientific view, is that possibly what these drugs do is they lower your set point in your brain. They lower the weight your brain is trying to keep you at. That may be actually the primary mechanism by which they work, although it may not, and there's a debate about that.
That's so interesting to think about. And to circle around to what you were saying about the firefighters, the one other factor that a lot of people don't understand in fire, especially in America, we do 24-hour shifts. But if you look at police and doctors and nurses and a lot of life-saving occupations that actually end up being, you know, struggling with their own health, is the shift work and the sleep deprivation. So going back to your umbrella analogy, now imagine there's holes in the umbrella as well. That's what, you know, that's another reason why their willpower is even more diminished. But in that conversation, there's a term called circadian scarring. Yeah. And so, you know, I worked for 14 years, and when I transitioned out, it literally took me about 5 years to be able to sleep properly again. And that's only 14 years. It's a short career compared to some people. So to parallel that, that seems to be what's happening with people that have gained a lot of weight. There's almost a kind of scarring of, as you said, that baseline, because that should be dynamic, really. You know, the feast and the famine, the John Candy caveman should then be able to come down, you know.
And I want to see that movie.
But, you know, it should be a sliding scale, but obviously it gets locked in because, like you said, it's an abnormal response. It's a artificial, you know, feast versus, you know, an actual feast before a winter in some European country.
And one of the reasons we know that is actually a study of, you know, that horrific game show, the World's Biggest Loser. So people haven't seen it. I hate it. It's a fucking evil show as far as I'm concerned, but it's, they get severely obese people and they compete to lose weight throughout the show. And they lose very dramatic amounts of weight, often through going through horrifying ordeals, which are actually not at all wise ways to lose weight. There was a very good study done that went back and looked at these the previous contestants on The World's Biggest Loser. And one of the things they discovered is these people who, and obviously that's a very dramatic weight loss, but even years later, they had to consume far fewer calories in a day to stay at the same weight as someone who had never been obese, right? Because their metabolism works so differently. So the way Dr. Giles Yeo described it to me, and there's a brilliant British doctor called Chris Van Tulleken who's written about this as well. Imagine two identical twins, right? They're both 75 pounds, but one of them has always been 75 pounds as an adult, and the other one went up to 95 pounds and came back down. The twin who went to 95 and came back will have to eat far fewer calories per day to stay at the same weight as than his brother does, right? Because his metabolism will be so damaged and so much slower, and because his body is fighting through that set point to bring his weight back up. So yeah, I think we're just that. And you're totally on the money about sleep, James. The I mean, the figures on this are incredible. The National Sleep Foundation says that on average, we sleep 20% less than people did a century ago. In Britain, children sleep 85 minutes less a night than they did in 1945, which is, I mean, staggering. And I interviewed lots of experts about this. And, you know, lack of sleep makes you crave sugary, shitty food, right, to give you energy. So lack of sleep is a huge factor in weight gain. And disturbed and interrupted sleep, there's a lot of evidence around shift workers, really screws with your brain and partly has these food effects as well. So I think you're absolutely right. There's a brilliant woman who you should interview. I'll give you an intro to her if you want, Professor Roxanne Prichard, also in Minneapolis at the University of Minnesota, who's done really shocking work on this and is a great person.
Beautiful. Yeah, that would be amazing. Thank you so much. People have listened to the show for a long time. Sleep deprivation comes up all the time because it's the elephant in the room for the mental health side. I mean, you think about not sleeping every third day and the inability to process, you know, anything that we see and do. The cancer conversation, if you listen again to all the greats in the sleep medicine world, I mean, shift work is a known carcinogen. So, but we shy away from that because that involves staffing. That involves getting more human beings to become first responders, to give them more rest and recovery. And a lot of people in leadership, and I use that term loosely, positions, you know, they just don't want to talk about that because that's going to involve them actually being courageous and advocating for their people. So I think it's a very important topic.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And it also, you know, it involves taking on power, right? I mean, actually, firefighters are pretty good at this because it's one of the most unionized parts of the United, one of the few unionized parts of the United States. So they're in a stronger position to do that than a lot of other people. But yeah, I totally agree with you. And there's been an enormous rise in people working through the night in the US and Britain, enormous rise in the last few years.
Well, I know we're running out of time. You touched on Japan finding solutions to some of the food issues. Now, I lived there 22 years ago for about 15 months as a stuntman. And even then, you know,
glamorous. That was such a glamorous statement.
it was pretty cool. You know, when I was there, there were some fast food, but it was probably at a transition. You know, there was still, you know, mostly traditional Japanese, you know, restaurants in Osaka. So what were they seeing in Japan? And then let's talk solutions. What were they bringing to the table?
So really often we're told there's basically a choice here. It's just weight loss drugs forever or being obese forever. And at an individual level, for a lot of people who are obese, that is actually the dilemma they're facing. But that does not have to be the choice for our children, our grandchildren, and future generations. And one of the ways we know that is because of Japan. So Japan got rich without getting fat. In the United States, 42.5% of people are obese. In Japan, it's 4.5% and projected to fall without these drugs. And obviously wanted to understand, well, how did they do it, right? So I went to Japan and spent a load of time there. It was riveting. It was totally fascinating. And there's lots of answers, but you might think, oh, it's just their genes, right? They must just have, they've won the genetic lottery. Actually, we know that's not true because in the late 19th century, lots of Japanese people went to go and live in Hawaii. And Japanese Hawaiians now, all these generations later, they can be studied and they're almost as overweight as other Hawaiians. So we know that it's not their genes because obviously their genes didn't radically mutate in the space of 100 years. So something else going on. We also know it's a relatively recent invention because actually Japanese people did not have the diet we think of as the Japanese diet until really quite recently, until the 1920s. The Japanese diet and their attitude towards it was actually deliberately invented by the Japanese government and kind of encouraged in the people. So there's lots of reasons why Japan has this very different level of obesity and very different health outcomes. I remember first day I went, I took one of my godsons and we were staying in a hotel and in the center of Tokyo. And it was a kind of, you know, kind of tourist hotel. But it was about half the people there were tourists from other parts of Japan and half were Western tourists. And they had two breakfasts laid out, right? There was the Western breakfast, which was like piles of pancakes and scrambled eggs and, you know, everyone could put bacon and sausages. And there was the Japanese breakfast, which was like tiny little bits of white fish, like little bowls of miso soup. And my godson came up to me. I'd already got my breakfast, and I had the Japanese breakfast. And my godson, who went to get both, came up to me and said, "I just saw the weirdest thing." And I was like, "What?" And he said, "There was a Japanese woman," and he pointed to her, not very discreetly. He said, "She went and she got like breakfast from their kind of food. And then she came over to the Western section and she took one French fry and put it on her plate. And then she came back a minute later and put that French fry back and took a smaller French fry." And I was like, and he's like, "Did you even know the concept of French fry existed in the singular? Right? Has anyone ever eaten one French fry in the entire history of the United States?" Right? Never. So they eat very differently. I spent a lot of time in the Tokyo School of Sushi. The great chief chef there, the head of it, Masaru Watanabe, gave me some really great lessons there. So obviously they eat much simpler food. They eat a lot of fish. They eat in a much simpler way. The way he put it to me is, you know, he was grilling a mackerel and I was watching this oil drip out of the mackerel. And he said, "What you have in the West is an addition cuisine. When you want to eat something, you add more to it. You add salt, butter, sugar, all sorts of things. We have a minus cuisine. We subtract from our food to make it taste more like itself," which I thought was a really interesting way of thinking about it. And he said, "Because our food is so simple, you have to put even more care into preparing it because you have to make every flavor fire." So in every meal, Japanese people actually eat a much more diverse range of ingredients than us. You know, we might have like a lasagna, but they'll have five small dishes. And actually, you're meant to eat them, I'm sure you saw this when you were there, James, in a triangle shape. So if you gave me, you know, a lasagna, some cabbage and some French fries, I would eat probably all the French fries first, then I'd eat all the cabbage, then I'd eat the lasagna, right? But we eat them in one after the other. In Japan, you don't do that. You have a little bit of the fish, then you have a little bit of the next dish, a little bit of the next dish, and you eat them in a triangle shape, which slows down your eating. Also, Japanese people are taught from when they're very young that you're meant to eat until you're 80% full. So if you get the feeling of being full when you're still eating, you've eaten too much, because it takes a while to get the signals. Actually, we now know the GLP-1 that tells you you've had enough. Right? So you're teaching me all these different ways in which Japanese people think about food. But I was thinking, God, well, how would we ever integrate this into our way of thinking? But crucially, this is taught from a very young age to children. I went to a school called Koenji Middle School. Actually, I went to the whole school, but I spent most time in Koenji Middle School. School in Tokyo, in a middle-class neighborhood. They showed me how they create this food culture, some of the key ways. So I was greeted at the door, me and my translator, by the school nutritionist. His name is Harumi Tatibe. Every school by law has to have a nutritionist. It's a really serious qualification. It's 3 years even after your teacher training. And your job is to design the food, oversee the food. Everything every child eats in Japan in school has to be completely non-processed, made from fresh on the day. And your job is to use this fresh food to teach the children what a healthy diet is, and also to counsel any kids who might be under-eating or overeating. So going to this school, I've got to tell you, it was the weirdest thing. There's 1,000 kids at that school. I spent all day there. I didn't see one overweight child. It was weird, right? So you're going through, so they have, you know, this delicious, amazing fresh food. I mean, it was frankly more like Nobu than like anything I ever ate at school, right? And I'm sitting talking to the kids, and Harumi, while they're eating, she uses the food to teach them. So she'll hold up like a red rope and she'll go, "Okay, this is calcium. What does calcium do?" And they'll go, "Ah, it makes your bones strong." She'll go, "Right, this blue rope, this is carbohydrates. What does that do? It gives you energy." And every time she adds a rope, she'll tie the rope together. And then she holds the rope up and go, "You see, you need all these things to have a healthy meal." She's constantly telling the kids, "You have to eat with your brain. What you eat makes your brain. You have to eat with your brain," right? And it was so weird speaking to these kids because I talked to them. It's like I spent the most time with the kids who were about 9 or 10. And I'd say to them, what's your favorite? One of the kids said, what's your favorite food? He said, broccoli. I love broccoli. Another kid, I'm like, what's your favorite food? He's like, salmon. And after a while, I turned to Chie, who's my translator, and I said, are these kids taking the piss out of me? Right? Like, what, their favorite food is broccoli? And Chie just looked, every Japanese person I discussed it with just looked puzzled when I said that. I was like, they were like, what do you mean? We teach our kids to like healthy food. They like healthy food. They just couldn't. And at one point, I was like getting so vexed by how healthy these kids were that I took out my mobile phone and I Googled British school dinner, right? And I took pictures of a typical British school meal, the kind of thing I ate at school. And I showed it to them. And these kids literally reacted like I'd showed them an ISIS beheading video, right? They began to scream. They looked like horrified and disgusted. They were like, where's the salad? I said, there is no salad. They were like, where's the vegetables? I was like, there are no vegetables. They were like completely, and they were like, what, you would eat this every day? And I was like, yeah, this little 10-year-old girl put her hand on my arm. Very sympathetic. She said, I'm worried about you. it was fascinating. I mean, there's lots of things they do in Japan, some of which we would not approve of and I wouldn't want to import as well. I'll give you an example of one of them, which is quite hard to get your head around. So in 2008, they had a panic in Japan because their obesity rate went up by like 0.2%. It was still like laughably low by our standards. And they introduced something called the Metabo Law, which is it's called that because when you develop obesity, you're at risk of something called metabolic syndrome, which is a combination of a whole series of really unpleasant problems. And so under the Metabo Law, every business in Japan, every year on a certain day, has to weigh all of its workers. And if your weight has gone up, you have to drop a plan with your employer to bring it down. And if the overall weight of the company goes up, you can be fined by the government, right? So it's pretty hardcore. So I went to a Japanese business to see how they do this. And it's pretty intense, right? I went to one called Tanika. I mean, okay, so they make health equipment. So they have a particular investment in, you know, they're the most enthusiastic edge of this. But when you arrive at work, you stand in front of a video screen. It says, hi, James. You walked 12,000 steps yesterday because everyone has to wear a Fitbit. These are the meals you ate because everyone takes a photo of their meals and shows them. Bob, who sits two desks down from you, hasn't weighed himself yet this week. Why don't you remind him? You're like, whoa. So I go up every morning. They do collective exercise together. They do yoga together at the time when everyone in an American office is eating bagels and donuts. And it's pretty intense, right? When I explain to people at this workplace, you know, if you did this in Britain or the US, we would burn the office down. And they were just like baffled. They were like, why? They just didn't, you know. So there's some aspects of Japan that are really different, but many which are not. And a lot of people will be listening and thinking, okay, that's very nice for Japan, but we're never going to do that. And it's a big change. I went to lots of places that have made changes. But I would just give an example to anyone our age who thinks we're never going to make that change. Think about smoking, right? When I was a kid, half of British people smoked. My mother smokes 70 cigarettes a day. There's a photo of me and her when I'm a baby. She's breastfeeding me, smoking and resting the ashtray on my stomach, right? When I discovered this photo a few years ago, I thought, oh, she'll feel guilty. I'll show it to her. She said, you were a fucking difficult baby. I needed that cigarette. But that was like really typical Scottish parenting at the time, right?
That should be a birthday card. That was beautiful.
Exactly. I was going to put the photo in my book and she said, you're not putting my tits in your book. She was very pissed off about it. But so you think about how big that change is. When we were kids, people smoked everywhere. They smoked on trains, on buses, on planes. My doctor used to smoke while he was examining me when I was a kid. I remember it, right? And we've gone from that to obviously we have issues around vaping now, which is a complex issue. But, you know, very few young people smoke now. It's gone from, you know, 50% to 12%, an enormous fall, right? So we can make these big changes if we want to. I believe we can. I believe we should. I believe we will if we band together and fight for it. So we're not trapped in the choice between these weight loss drugs and the 12 big risks that they cause that I go through in the book. and the risks of obesity forever. We can make different choices, but that requires bigger social changes. So what I'm hoping, at the end of the book, I go through five possible scenarios for what might happen now with these drugs, from the worst case scenario, which is that we find out they cause some catastrophic health problem, to the best case scenario. For me, the best case scenario is that lots of people benefit from these drugs, but they also wake us up to say, how the fuck did we end up with this choice? Right, this, we shouldn't have to drug ourselves to be healthy. Why don't we learn from Japan, change how we live, and get to a point where our kids don't face this risky and dangerous choice?
Well, that is a beautiful place to round off this conversation. I want to be mindful of your time. So the book is Magic Pill. For everyone listening, out on May 7th, so it'll be out by the time this drops. Where can people around the world find it?
If you want to know where to get the audiobook, the ebook, or the physical book, you can go to my website. It's johannahari.com. And you can see where to get that book or my previous books. You can see where to follow me on social media, though I don't look at it that much. And you can see a load of other things as well. Hooray.
Beautiful. Well, I want to thank you so much. I'd love to get you back on and talk about Stolen Focus one day, because dove into the Magic Pill, and rightly so. But it's been another amazing conversation. I know how busy you are normally, so I want to be so thankful for you. Oh my God, I can't even spit out my last closing. So I want to thank you for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
I always love talking to you, James. What a pleasure. Thank you so much.